Baseball and horse racing are two sports that have been with us since before the Civil War, and we still enjoy them in one way or another today. I am Suzanne Lang, bringing you A Novel Idea. The Oakland Athletics are a team that came from Kansas City and may be heading to Las Vegas, and in the meantime have been an up-and-down presence in the Bay Area. During one of their lulls, manager Billy Martin came to Oakland and shook things up. In just a minute, we'll explore Billy Ball, Billy Martin and the Resurrection of the Oakland A's with its author, Dale Tafoya. Later in the show, we'll hear my conversation with Mark Schrager. He started out writing a history of the Kentucky Derby and discovered that 13 of the 15 jockeys in the initial Derby were African American in a sport that seldom sees black jockeys today. His book is The Kentucky Derby, 13 Black Jockeys, One Shady Owner, and The Little Red Horse That Wasn't Supposed to Win. Stay with us for a sporting time. It's a novel idea. Billy Martin was a Major League Baseball player and then manager who had stints with the Detroit Tigers, the Minnesota Twins, famously with the New York Yankees, and was brought on to manage the slumping Oakland A's, who were slated to soon move to Denver, who at the time didn't have a Major League team and badly wanted one. Oakland wasn't quite ready to give up or let go. Dale Tafoya is a journalist who writes about baseball. His work has appeared in Sports Illustrated, Baseball Digest, and the New York Post, among other places. His work includes Bash Brothers, A Legacy Subpoenaed, about the age of steroids, and Mark McGwire and Jose Canseco. He's also published One Season in Rocket City, how the 1985 Huntsville Stars brought minor league baseball fever to Alabama. And we'll talk with him about that book on a future show. But now, let's listen to our conversation about Billy Ball. Dale Tafoya, welcome. You have written three books, and each one is about baseball. And each has the Oakland A's as a central or peripheral element to it. And though each book has very specific stories to relate, they also really expose various elements of the game and the profession and the business of baseball, of which casual fans might not fully be aware. So I'd like to start out by just talking about your own relationship and interest in baseball.
Well, as a young kid growing up in San Leandro, California, that's in the East Bay, I was about 10 miles away from the Oakland Coliseum where the A's played. So growing up, I was a big fan of baseball and professional wrestling. So I would go to the A's games. My grandma, she worked at the Golden Age Center in Oakland. So when the former A's owners, the Haas family, Walter A. Haas Jr. was the owner. When they owned the team, they would give the Golden Age Center tickets to the game. And so my grandma, she ran that facility. So she used to bring 50 to 100 tickets home with her. And I stayed with her a lot. And so I took a lot of those tickets. And sometimes I even cut school to go to the games. And that began a love affair for baseball. And the Oakland A's were my home team. And that's when I really developed that excitement and that passion for baseball. And I still had that passion 20, 30 years later. I started an Oakland A's podcast back in 2010, and I had a run with that. 2004, I started writing the book Bash Brothers about two prolific players for the A's, Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire, and completed that. And I wrote Billy Ball, Billy Martin, The Resurrection in 2019, and then now One Season in Rocket City in 2023. So that's kind of how I started. I think when you speak about writers and journalists that cover baseball, I think they all started out as fans. So, and that's kind of how my journey started, Suzanne.
You really do drill pretty deep and seem to have a lot of real direct sources, including Sandy Alderson, and you mentioned Jose Canseco, Roy Eisenhart, and many, many others. And I'm just interested in how you've worked to get such good and perhaps sometimes esoteric information about this organization.
It wasn't always like that, because when you start writing books and start writing about certain players and executives in the organization, they don't im immediately embrace you. They kind of evaluate you, and maybe they see you write some prolific work or good work, and they respect it. But I think the key for me is relationships. I think you have to build trust with these people. I think in social media, I think that's that. I think that's very important, because I think for a lot of young writers, there is a temptation to write tweets or write posts on Facebook to go viral and to get thousands of retweets. But you have to just be positive, and you have to respect people, because a lot of these very important people around baseball, they're going to follow what you're writing, and they're going to know if you're going to be fair. Or they may indulge some information with you, and maybe they're going to see if you're going to run with it and expose it on Twitter. To me, it's you have to build a trust, and I think that's ultimately was the key for me, is relationships.
Well, you certainly have built a lot of them, and I think it's what makes your material so rich and feeling very present in the situations you're talking about. So, one of the things I want to talk about here is Billy Ball. Billy Ball, Billy Martin, and the Resurrection of the Oakland A's is your book. And before we get into Billy Martin and his journey to and from the A's, we have to get into the situation of the Oakland Athletics before his arrival, I think. Maybe we need to start with Charles O. Finley, the owner of the A's. He's the one who brought the A's to Oakland from Kansas City, and he was notoriously cheap as these things go. And though he created a championship team in the mid-70s, and other owners too, including George Steinbrenner, who is also an omnipresent character in the wings of your stories here. But Finley was pretty notorious for running through managers, something like 15 managers in 20 years. And he wanted another championship team. So set up the A's at that time leading up to the hiring of Billy Martin.
So, Suzanne, I wanted to be fair with Charlie Finley, and I know I covered the late 70s A's teams. So it wasn't a very glamorous time for Charlie Finley, and the optics surrounding him during that time may have not been very good, but he did bring the A's to Oakland in 1968, and he ultimately hired Billy Martin, a difference maker, before the 1980 season. But you're right, Charlie Finley. I mean, he was the owner of three consecutive Oakland A's championships in the early 70s, five straight division titles. But something called free agency really shook his ownership model. Free agency was negotiated in the MLB contract, where now all of his players, they can shop their services to the highest bidder. And that really threatened his ownership model, because he liked keeping these great players that helped him to win championships. He liked to keep them under control for a long time, under his pure purview, and he was able to do that. But once free agency hit in 1967, these players, they were lured from other major league teams with more money, and they abandoned him. They signed with other teams, and suddenly Charlie Finley is without these star players. And it was just a really tough time in Oakland in the late 70s. In 1979, for example, the A's lost 108 games and drew only a little over 306,000 fans. I mean, minor league clubs today draw more than that. The A's were so bad, they were called the Oakland Pathetics in Triple A's. They were on the verge of relocation. And that was when Charlie Finley hired Billy Martin in February as manager after that season. So It was just a very, very tough time. There was not a lot of discipline on the A's in 1979. A player named Miguel De Leon went after manager, one of the manager of the A's, and with a bat. Some players like Glenn Burke just abandoned the team in late 79 and just left elsewhere. A lot of the players, they avoided going on road trips by pretending they were sick. So it was just a tough time for the A's. And in one game in 1979, I believe it was April 17th, they drew a crowd of 653 fans in a game. 653. And so it was just a very tough time. And the A's needed, and the area, Oakland needed a firecracker leader like Billy Martin to come in and make the difference. And he did.
You just brought up a couple of things I want to follow up quickly with you on. Free agency is something that seems to have really changed the game, especially for owners like Finley. And I'm wondering how it has affected the game, and does it continue to have ramifications for teams trying to field a winning team?
Absolutely. I mean, when you have these great talented players that are being wooed by these owners with a lot of resources and a lot of money, they're going to join those teams. And when you have the smaller market teams or owners with not so much money, they're not going to be able to afford the big superstars. For example, like the Oakland A's owner John Fisher, he may not be able to afford, or may not decide not to pursue those free agents. So you're not going to have a star-studded roster, and that's why a lot of the owners have turned to their farm system and through trades and drafts to field a team. And because a lot of these players, they're stars, but they were rookies and they were minor leaguers at one point. And I think a lot of these owners have decided to focus on bolstering their farm system and getting these players where they're young. And they know that eventually, after 5 or 6 years, and they star for the club, and they do well, that they're eventually going to lose these players to free agencies, to deep-pocketed owners. So that's kind of a cycle we see. But yeah, Suzanne, free agency still is absolutely a big factor in Major League Baseball for attendance and also in the standings.
You also said that Finley was looking to move the team out of Oakland, and I think Denver was an interested market in the team. But then the Haas family came in, and this was all kind of at the time also when Billy Martin was brought in. So can you just talk a little bit about that aspect of it, of Finley wanting to move the team, but really people wanting the team to stay in Oakland, and how that came about?
When an owner plays the relocation card or publicly plays that card, fans are not going to want to show up. They're going to resign to the fact that the team is moving. And that's what the current Oakland A's ownership has been dealing with. That if you're playing the relocation card, you better know what you're doing, because fans are going to stop showing up. And Charlie Finley did. And you're right. In December of 1977, the deal was in place. This oil tycoon in Denver, Marvin Davis, announced that he purchased the A's, and the A's were going to be moving to Denver in 1978 and play it at Mile High Stadium there. So it was all set and done, and all the writers were writing Charlie Finley's obituary as an owner and kind of summarizing the A's 10-year stay in Oakland. But suddenly, led by Mayor Lionel Wilson, Oakland's mayor, said, "Wait a minute. Charlie Finley signed a 20-year lease when he arrived in 1967. We have 10 more years on this lease at the Oakland Coliseum." So that was the trump card that the city of Oakland used. So Finley was essentially stuck in Oakland till 1987, and he could not move the franchise until then. So he was basically stuck in Oakland, and that's when he hired Billy Martin, who was just fired from the New York Yankees after a scuffle with a marshmallow salesman in Minnesota. And Finley hired him a day before pitchers and catchers were scheduled to report to spring training in 1980. And that's when he arrived and really was the difference maker there. So, and that's what Billy Martin did. He was a specialist in making bad teams good. Billy Martin was a doctor for sick teams. And Billy Martin, when he arrived, he created enough interest. He made that bad team a commodity for Walter A. Haas Jr. to purchase in August of 1980. And the Haas family and Billy Martin's leadership took that organization just to new heights.
So let's talk about Billy Martin. He was a player, and he landed with the Yankees at a time when some greats were there, including Mickey Mantle, and he had a decent career with them until he got traded. And he bounced around a bit as a player and a manager. So tell us about his trajectory as a player and how he migrated into being a manager. And I think we should mention that Billy Martin was a local boy from Berkeley.
Yes, Billy Martin was born in Berkeley. He went to Berkeley High. And he also, in 1948, with those local ties, he played for the Oakland Oaks under his future manager, Casey Stengel. And he helped lead the Oakland Oaks to their first Pacific League title since 1927. So he had been a part of an East Bay baseball renaissance in the past before. But Billy was just, he was born into tension, resistance, and poverty during the Great Recession. And he just played with a ferocious competitiveness and a drive. He was brash and explosive. And when he joined the Yankees, he was a part of that great Yankee championship run in the late 40s and early 50s. In 1953, I believe he led the World Series. I think it's still a record with 12 hits in a World Series. In 1952, he made a great a catch on the infield off the bat of Jackie Robinson, which was very critical in the World Series. So he had a great great run, but Billy was controversial. He would fight, he would drink, and the Yankees ended up trading him because they felt that he was a bad influence on Mickey Mantle. But you're right, he was never the same player once he left New York. But he was a baseball savant. He was in love with baseball, and he got into managing after he was let go by the Twins in the late 60s. At that point, he just made every team that he managed better. He managed the Minnesota Twins. He immediately got them better. He managed the Detroit Tigers. He immediately improved that club. He managed the Texas Rangers. He immediately improved that club. He managed the Yankees. He took them to a World Series in 1977. He won the World Series in 1977. So he was a guy, a leader, that just brought an immediate adrenaline rush to a company, to an organization. And it wouldn't last long. He would just ignite a franchise, but his shelf life wasn't very long. And I think he would get bored, burn out, and he would go to the next city and manage. And when I think of Billy Martin, I think of him like an old-fashioned evangelist crusader that would go to a city, have a revival, and bring life to it, and then go on to the next city. So that's kind of how Billy Martin ended up in Oakland in his early years.
You quote Bruce Jenkins as calling Billy Ball brilliantly reckless. So describe what some of the hallmarks of what became to be known as Billy Ball. What were the hallmarks of that on the field?
Well, Billy, he just kept opposing teams and managers on their toes. I mean, he kept them guessing. He was daring and unpredictable. His bag of tricks frustrated opponents with double steals, the stealing of home, hit and runs, suicide squeezes. During a game against the Tigers, Billy called a successful triple steal and created havoc for the defense. And after the inning, the Tigers catcher Lance Parrish smashed a water cooler with a bat in the dugout. And the pitcher Jack Morris threw his glove and fired a ball to center field. They were so rattled and mad. And Billy just smirked in the dugout. he knew how to get into the head of an opposing manager rent-free. He was also very observant. On April 25th, 1981, for example, he noticed an enlarged batter's box before a game in Seattle. The chalk lines of the batter's box were altered and extended further toward the pitcher. And it was 1 foot further than it was supposed to be. And this would allow Seattle hitters to hit a curveball before it curved. Rick Langford, the ace pitcher, was on the mound, and it would give them an advantage. So Seattle's manager, Maury Wills, had tried to pull a fast one by doing that. He ordered the groundskeeper to expand the batter's box. So Billy was observant. He saw the discrepancy and brought it to the attention of the umpires, and they redid the whole batter's box, and Wills was later suspended 2 games for doctoring the batter's box. So he was just a feisty manager, and he just always frustrated opposing managers and opposing teams and just threw them off their game. That was how Billy Ball was characterized.
And Billy Martin, when he came to Oakland, he was really marketed. He was a hometown boy, and he brought people into the stands. He was the draw. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, Billy Martin could have been the mayor of Oakland during that time, because it wasn't just about Martin's aggressive, unpredictable style of play in the field and all the complete games the pitchers threw. The A's, led by Andy Dolich, great marketing mind, and still is today, and he was the marketing director for the A's back then. The A's built this Clio award-winning, the Oscars for the advertising world, this advertising campaign centered around Billy Martin, Billy Ball, a different brand of baseball. That's what it was called. So before the Bo Jackson, the Bo Nose ads, and Nike's Michael Jordan ads, there was Ogilvie Mather's trailblazing Billy Ball campaign, where for the first time, athletes acted in front of the camera. And when we talk about interest, like I said before, in 1979, the A's drew just over 306,000 fans. By 1982, the A's had drawn over 1.7 million fans at the Oakland Coliseum that season, shattering their all-time franchise record. And that includes stops in Philadelphia and Kansas City. They would have broke that record in 1981, the year before, if it weren't for the MLB strike that erased 22 home dates for the A's. So that was kind of the interest. And if the listeners want to see some of the Billy Ball clips, go to YouTube and put Billy Ball commercials, and you'll see some of the marketing genius behind this Billy Ball campaign that the A's put out. For me, I think it was the greatest Oakland A's revival in Oakland A's history, that Billy Ball campaign. And Billy Martin built a cult-like following in Oakland, and he made the A's a pop culture phenomenon. He was on the front cover of Time in 1981. The A's 5 pitching aces were on the front cover of Sports Illustrated. And this whole dream and marketing campaign was riding on the shoulders of this flawed guy.
And did players like working with him, with this, you know, stealing and bunting and pickoffs? And did they like working with Billy Martin?
I think they did, because when Billy Martin got to Oakland, there was these young kids that were there that didn't have a lot of confidence. They were used to playing. They were a losing club. They were playing in front of crowds of 2,500 at the Coliseum. And Billy Martin just instilled confidence in these young players. And that's what he did. He made them believe in themselves. When he'd deal with these players, he would hypnotize them. He would make them believe they could win. And Billy Martin made the world pay attention to these young kids. But as far as in his major league career, some players loved him, some players hated him. For example, some of the star players and some of the narcissistic players hated him, that they wanted to be the star. But because Billy Martin was so popular, he was the star. When we talk about the Billy Ball movement, the A's, the face of the A's wasn't a player. It was the manager, Billy Martin. And that type of stardom can rub some players the wrong way. But these young kids are still, they're older now, these players. They're still very loyal to Billy, because he could just instill confidence in them. And as you see, They lost 108 games in 1979, and by 1981, they're facing the storied New York Yankees in the American League Championship Series, a series away from the World Series. And that's how Billy Martin was able to hypnotize these players.
Some said that Billy didn't understand pitchers, but many pitchers went complete games under his management. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Billy and pitchers.
Yeah, well, you're right. A big criticism of Billy Martin is that the pitchers, the starting staff completed 94 complete games. That's absolutely unheard of. But that's what Billy didn't have a hugely talented roster. So that's what he had to do, and that there would be no resurrection of the A's without those pitchers pitching the complete games. And there's been criticism where a lot of the pitchers that threw so many pitches during games without relief ruined their arms, and it damaged their arms. And that's been a criticism. But Bob Lacey led the A's with six saves in 1980. Billy had a very shaky bullpen. And because Billy always poured his soul into winning, he allowed these pitchers to pitch complete games in all nine innings. And you have to remember, too, a lot of these young kids, the pitchers, Mike Norris, Steve McCaddy, Rick Langford, Matt Keogh, and Brian Kingman, this was the first time that they were receiving any notoriety. They were on the front cover of Sports Illustrated. They were getting this attention from the world, and they wanted to stay on that mound. They didn't want to give the ball up to Billy. Mike Norris told me a story where Billy wanted to take him out, and Mike Norris said, "Billy, get back in the dugout." And Billy went back. So these young pitchers also, they didn't want to give up the ball. They were fighting to stay on that mound. So you had that dynamic as well. So, yeah, there would be no resurrection without these starters pitching all those complete games.
So with all this success, there are people in the stands and a winning team. I mean, he really brought the team up. Why was his tenure so short then? And how did he end up leaving the organization?
Not only was Billy a manager, the Haas family made Billy director of player development. So Billy Martin was also essentially the general manager of the A's during that time. During his other stints with other teams, he was a great manager, but he always was interested in promoting. He was also interested in other aspects of the game, like being an executive. But really, his true genius was a field manager. But as I said earlier, his shelf life doesn't last long. And that was consistent with the A's. And I think what happens is he gets bored. He wants to be in other positions. By 1982, a lot of the A's pitching staff went on the disabled list, and they had a horrible season standing-wise, although they did break the record for attendance. And I think that he lost some of the clubhouse. Some players turned on him. Some players turned him out. Again, that's kind of the package when you have Martin. At the end of his tenure with teams, it's not always pretty. And plus, I think, as we discussed earlier, having so much loyalty, as much as he loved saving that franchise in Oakland, he had so much loyalty to the Yankees. I think he had an itch to return to the Yankees. And the A's ended up firing. He had a fallout with the A's ownership. He wrecked his office in the Oakland Coliseum after one game in 1982. He punched some walls. Him and his coaching staff destroyed the office. So I think that didn't earn any points with ownership. So the A's fired him during the World Series in 1982, and shortly after that, he returns to New York to manage the Yankees. So, and I think he ended up managing the Yankees five different times during his managerial career before he passed on Christmas Day in 1989. So I think he did his job in Oakland. He saved that franchise from relocation. He generated so much interest and made the A's into a commodity where Finley finally had a purchaser for the team, and that was the Haas family, Walter A. Haas Jr. And Walter A. Haas Jr. bought that team, not just for the money. Obviously, there's a business model there, but he wanted to keep the A's in Oakland as a landmark for the community, and he did that. So, yes, Billy Martin burned out at the end in Oakland, but boy, did he make an impact.
Billy Ball, Billy Martin, and the resurrection of the Oakland A's. I'm talking to its author, Dale Tafoya. Is there anything else you want to leave us with about Billy Martin and this book?
I just think that with Billy Martin and Billy Ball, Billy Martin, the resurrection of the Oakland A's, and I think it just speaks of leadership. And I think it speaks of you'll have some leaders that come to an organization and could be dynamic and just shake it and immediately turn it around. Like I said, I think Billy Martin was a Mr. Right Now manager leader, where his impact wouldn't last very long, but he can go there and just bring that adrenaline rush to a team and completely turn it around and hypnotize young players. So I think it just speaks to leadership, and I think that's kind of what sticks out to me.
Do you think he learned a lot early in his career from Casey Stengel?
Oh, absolutely. Billy Martin would read a lot of psychology books, and Billy Martin was very astute in leading people. And that's what he got that from Casey Stengel. Casey Stengel really valued psychology and how to lead men. Billy Martin learned that at the feet of Casey Stengel, and it started with the Oakland Oaks. And he was able to use that in his managerial style.
Billy Ball, Billy Martin, and the Resurrection of the Oakland A's, Dale Tafoya. Thank you so much for talking with us today about it.
Oh, my pleasure. Be well. I had a blast, Suzanne.
Dale Tafoya. Look for him on a future show. His enthusiasm about baseball is infectious. Let's take a short break and then talk with Mark Schrager on the Kentucky Derby.
Here comes another hit. Leading off number four is Covelli Chris. Spider-Man, the gold glover, Mr. Josh Reddick. 52 defeat, and I'm your NSS status. Like a rocket off his bat while we left quick. Off the bench in left field, there goes Seth Smith. Hitting balls like the bleachers hit the big drum. New additions, Jed Lowry and Chris Young. John Jessel, Derek Norris sit behind the plate. 6'8 at first base, yeah, that's Big Nate. Josh Donaldson, Adam Rosales. Eric Sogard up the middle, yep, they real solid. Hitting hard, watch them fly like a cannon. Ball. Batting left 37, Mr. Brendan Moss. Shout out to the River Cats playing in the heat. Michael Taylor, Luke Monson, Jamal Weeks. Oakland Athletics, Oakland Athletics, Oakland Athletics. Oakland A's in the house, y'all. Oakland Athletics, Oakland Athletics. Oakland A's in the house, y'all.
I'm Suzanne Lang with a novel idea. What is a turf writer? Well, someone who writes about horse racing, and Mark Schrager has published hundreds of articles on the subject and has won awards for his books on the subject, which include The Great Sweepstakes of 1877 and Diane Crump, A Horse Racing Pioneer's Life in the Saddle. She fought to break through the gender barrier for female jockeys. His latest book is The First Kentucky Derby, 13 Black Jockeys, One Shady Owner, and The Little Red Horse That Wasn't Supposed to Win. Let's listen. Mark Schrager, thank you for talking with us today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I think it's fair to say that you write about horses and racing. You're a turf writer.
That's correct.
In this particular book, you began writing one book about the First Kentucky Derby, but had to pivot as information revealed itself. So let's start right there.
This book was originally intended to be a history book. about the Kentucky Derby specifically. And I'd begun writing it that way about the horses who were in there, and got to the jockeys and found that, much to my surprise, 13 of the 15 jockeys were African-American. And I compared that with my current day experience, when you almost never see a Black jockey at the races, certainly not at Santa Anita and Del Mar and the tracks I tend to hang out at. And I just kept coming back to that thought, what are all these Black jockeys doing here? And I had to learn more about it. It seemed that I wasn't telling the full story if I couldn't not only discuss where all these Black jockeys had come from, but where they had gone, because they didn't seem to be around anymore. And the more I wrote about that, the more interesting it became for me. And that became one of the three major focuses of the book as I went along.
Yes. What you discovered was that the African Americans who got involved with horses and racing was largely through slavery. You point out that the horse racing and wagering was around since the beginning of our country, really. And slaves were assigned to trade and ride horses. And then after emancipation, many stayed on in that capacity.
Okay, well, if you go through the old newspapers of that day and age, especially the sporting newspapers, which were more prevalent then than they are now, you see things like jockey for sale advertisements. And these were talented riders, people who had been in the saddle almost literally since birth. And they would be sold like you would sell a plow or a set of horseshoes or something like that. And they were, a lot of them were not allowed to use their last names. They would be put into the saddle and ridden as Ned or Cornelius or William or something like that, because that giving them their full names might suggest that they had an actual existence, an actual human life away from that of their owner. And that was not considered something that the owners wanted to have. So it was a very different time. And you see jockeys that came into the sport as riders when they were 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, because light weight is very important in racing. If a horse is carrying less weight, it tends to run faster. And so these children were being put in the saddle and were winning a lot of races for their owners. And that lasted right up until the end of slavery, till emancipation in 1865. So it's a very different thing. It's almost hard to talk about people owning people and having slaves that they put aboard 1,000-pound racehorses when they're 8 years old, because then the horse will run a little bit faster and maybe win some more bets for the owner. But that was the reality of the times.
And then after the Civil War, and the Civil War had a big impact on horse breeding, and that really had an impact for years to come, until maybe breeding got back in more of a productive mode. So some of these Black jockeys were quite successful, and you even mentioned that Isaac Murphy, you describe him as a star, and that he had lucrative winnings.
Well, he was more than a star. He was a superstar. He was the highest paid athlete in America for a series of years, when that just didn't happen. He had white friends. He had white business associates. He partied hardy with his white friends, and that made some people unhappy. But his greatness was so evident that most people tended to see it as something that just happened. Murphy claimed to have ridden 44% winners, which is just an impossible number. An author went back and tried to do a study, and went through several hundred of his races and came up with a 35% figure, which would top every rider that is alive today or has been alive for the last 100 years. He was just an amazing jockey. He had a very sad ending, unfortunately. He died at the age of 30, 35, I think it was, of what was described as pneumonia. But the fact is, he like so many jockeys of the era, slowly starved himself to death trying to make the weights he was required to be on the horses of those days. So that was Murphy, a very sad ending. But he was followed by a string of jockeys who actually won 8 Kentucky Derbies in the next 13 years. Willie Sims and others of those times, who were still dominating racing, even as the 1900s were approaching, by which time the feelings of the country had changed toward black jockeys. There were more white jockeys, there were fewer black jockeys for a number of reasons that I bring up in the book. And gradually, as you go from 1875 to about 1905, 30 years, you go from a situation in which black jockeys are 85% of the Kentucky Derby starters until a time when you don't see a black jockey in the Kentucky Derby for 79 years from 1921 to 2000.
You mention in the book that the KKK, which was on the rise, would threaten black jockeys, and that even on the track, there was foul play between white and black jockeys.
Well, one author described it as race war on the racetracks. Yeah. White jockeys would form jockey unions, white jockey unions, and they would agree that they would ride their races. So not that they would, that one of them would necessarily win, but that the black jockeys in the race would all lose. And they had very dangerous practices. They would slip up next to a black jockey who looked like he was doing well, and they would put their foot under his foot and just flip him right out of the saddle that way. There were situations in which white jockeys were noted to have lined their horses up across the track so that no black jockey could get through. And if a black man on a horse tried to get through that line of horses, they would slam together and cut him off. It became such a difficult and dangerous thing that owners and trainers of horses who might have been sympathetic to the African-American riders who were trying to win at that point found that in many cases they just couldn't give them rides anymore because their horses were put in too much danger. And these were people whose livelihoods depended on their horses doing well at the track.
I want to focus on one or two more jockeys. Jimmy Wink, his nickname was Winkfield.
Winkfield.
They called him the Black Maestro. And as this climate, as we were talking about, was changing in America, he had quite a successful career racing in Russia. So you tell the story of then, you know, the Russian Revolution happens and he manages to flee, but with a bunch of the Tsar's horses. So can you talk a little bit about him? And he had kind of an amazing life, I would say.
I would say so too. This is one of the most amazing biographies I've ever read. Just as a jockey, his record will never, ever be equaled or even approached. He won 2 Kentucky Derbies. He won a Clark Stakes, 2 Moscow Derbies, 3 Russian Derbies, 5 Russian Oaks, 2 Warsaw Derbies, a German Grosser Preis von Baden, and the Grand Prix de Deauville, all in a career of roughly 30 years. And I couldn't help putting into the book, imagine what his record in America might have been if he'd just been allowed to stay. But after he retired, he was quoted as saying that, well, of course, I had to go to Russia. It was so much more liberal an environment for a Black rider than America was. And you think about Russia, the land of the Tsar, the breeding ground for the communist revolution, and to think of it as being a more liberal place for any group of people than America is, it kind of pulled me up short. You know, it really makes you think about what America is and could be, but Wingfield, he was the youngest of, trying to recall, I think it was 17 children, grew up in the South. His first race that he rode, he wound up being suspended for a year because his horse broke on the outside of the pack. And he decided that the best way to ride the race was being on the inside. So he just went straight over the jockey on the inside. And they gave him a year to think about maybe finding a better strategy. He won two consecutive Kentucky Derbies in 1901 and 1902. No American jockey won two Derbies again until Ron Turcott rode Reaver Ridge and the Great Secretariat in 1972 and 73 to win the Derby. And nobody's ever won three. One of the other black jockeys of those olden times, Willie Sims, won in 1896 and 1898 and might have won in 1897, but nobody put him on a horse. So that was rather unfortunate. But Wingfield was just amazing. He was a one-of-a-kind rider. He was an amazing talent. And like I said, his record will never be equaled.
And it sounds also like he was a dedicated horseman, too. I mean, that he would really risk a lot to save these horses from potential destruction if they remained in their situation in Russia. And he fled with this pack of horses.
Yeah, this was right after the Bolshevik Revolution, and he had heard that the newly in power communist government was going to confiscate all of the Tsar's belongings, and that would include about 100 horses plus another 100 or so of the horses belonging to the Tsar's supporters. And these were horses that had won the most important races in Russia. And now Wingfield realizes that he had to get those horses out of there or they were going to be lost. So he and some of the trainers and jockeys that had ridden for the Tsar's supporters got all of their horses, put together a gigantic pack of horses, there were over 200 of them, and drove them across nearly 1,000 miles of Russia to get them to Warsaw, where they would be safe and where racing was being held. And he was successful in doing that. They only lost a few horses on the way to illness and injury, and they managed to find food. They managed to find, you know, veterinary care when they needed it. And it's kind of a miraculous thing that they got this amazing number of good horses, of important horses, from Moscow and St. Petersburg to Warsaw, and did it with some success. He actually had a second occasion many years later when he was training horses in France, and Hitler and the Germans, the Nazis, came into France, and the German soldiers were going into the racetracks and the training stables. And sooner or later, of course, they came across Wingfield. He was pretty successful as a trainer too. And they began trying to decide how they could confiscate all of these horses. And they did so rather roughly. They were moving five and six horses into a stall that was intended for one. And they were using a bit rougher methods than Wingfield wanted them to use on his horses, which are, you know, fairly delicate creatures. And Wingfield, at risk of his life, actually picked up a pitchfork and told the German soldiers, stop doing that. And how easily might they have shot this black man who was holding a pitchfork up and threatening their lives? But I guess they saw the strength and they saw how important this was to him. And maybe they realized that he knew more about it than they did. And they listened to what he wanted done and they did things his way. And then he got out of Dodge. He left France and came back to America for a while.
But just for a while, because I think that he moved back to France and that's where he lived a very long life there.
He did, and I think he was persuaded to leave America the final time because he'd been invited to be the guest of Sports Illustrated at a pre-Derby party to celebrate the coming day's Kentucky Derby. And being a Black man in an area where that still wasn't necessarily preferred by the majority race, he was denied admission to the party that he'd been invited to. And he was with his daughter. They were both humiliated, felt humiliated anyway. And he decided that he was just going to go back to France and live out the rest of his life. And he lived to be 91.
Amazing. I thought his was an amazing story. So let's move on to the jockey who won the first Kentucky Derby is Oliver Lewis. And he was riding the horse Aristides. So maybe talk a little bit about Oliver and then let's talk about this amazing horse.
Okay, well, let me correct you just a little bit. The pronunciation is Aristides.
Aristides, okay, thank you.
Yeah, Oliver Lewis is another fascinating character who unfortunately becomes less fascinating after he retires from the saddle because the press just loses track of him. But he was an excellent jockey. He was probably the second or third string jockey for the Price McGrath stable, which had lots of good horses and lots of good jockeys. And Lewis was given the task of riding Aristides to lose. He was told that the winning horse was going to be a horse named Chesapeake, one of Price McGrath's other horses, and he wanted to win with Chesapeake. He thought he was a better horse than Aristides, and so that was where he had his money, and that was what mattered for Price McGrath, was where was his money? That was going to determine strategy. So he told Lewis, I want you to go to the front, tire out those other front-running horses, and then step aside, and Chesapeake is going to come flying by in the stretch, and I'll win the trophy, and I'll win all my bets, and maybe I'll give you a bonus, you know. And so that was what was supposed to happen. And McGrath positioned himself at the top of the stretch at what's now called Churchill Downs. Back then it was the Louisville Jockey Club course, and realized about halfway through the race that Chesapeake wasn't doing so well. He was laboring at the back of the pack and didn't look very interested, and he was clearly not going to win. And so Price McGrath began waving his hat and pinwheeling his arms and screaming, go on with them, Oliver, go on with them. And Oliver Lewis had about 3 seconds at the top of the stretch to figure out what to do. He had been directed to lose the race, and now his owner was making these odd signals and behaving in a crazy way. And it was up to Lewis, a 19-year-old jockey, to decide, what do I do? Well, he decided, I'm going to go on and win the race. And that was what he did. And so the irony is that H. Price McGrath, the owner of both of those horses, is remembered today, 100 and many years later, as the owner of the first Kentucky Derby. But the irony is he won with the wrong horse, and he probably lost every bet he made that day and probably went home not very happy about it. Oh, and let me get back and continue with Lewis, because he retired shortly after the Derby. He was 19 or maybe a very early 20. And I never found anything that anyone had written, and believe me, I looked, about why he retired so abruptly and why he left the sport where he was just beginning to experience success. He had that one shining moment as the winner of the first Derby, and then he's gone. And I would speculate that maybe he gained weight, maybe he was injured, maybe he did something to make his primary benefactor, H. Price McGrath, maybe he made him unhappy in some way, but whatever, he was gone. And there were rumors about him. What was he going to do? Maybe he was going to train horses. He thought about becoming a bookmaker. There was one story that he was the inventor of the past performance sheets that have been running in the daily racing form for, I don't know, 100 years or so. and that he did that for his gambling clients as a bookmaker, that he would favor them with unique information about how the horses had run. Some of that may be true, some of it may be just stories made up. What is known is that he pretty much dropped out of sight after he left race riding. He lived to be about 68. He's buried in an absolutely fascinating place, African Graveyard Number 2 in Lexington, Kentucky, which is the final resting place of so many of the jockeys and trainers and grooms and of almost the entire Black population of Kentucky racing in those days. And you walk through there and it's like walking through a piece of history, and it's just absolutely fascinating.
I'm talking with Mark Schrager. The book is The First Kentucky Derby, 13 Black Jockeys, One Shady Owner, and The Little Red Horse That Wasn't Supposed to Win. Mark, your book is filled with lots of statistics. Some of your descriptions are like, I feel like you're giving a play-by-play to an actual horse race, so that adds some dynamism. And you thread a lot of history throughout the story that kind of frames the story in where we were at in this country at that time. A lot of research, and I thank you very much for talking with us today.
I very much appreciate those comments. The history is what's really important to me, and I do try and get that across to my readers. So thank you for those very complimentary words.
My conversation with Mark Schrager, and his book is The First Kentucky Derby, 13 Black Jockeys, One Shady Owner, and The Little Red Horse That Wasn't Supposed to Win. Earlier, we heard from baseball writer Dale Tafoya and his book, Billy Ball, Billy Martin and the Resurrection of the Oakland A's. And we'll visit with Dale again a little later in the season. I thank Dale and Mark for spending time with me, and I thank you for listening. I'm Suzanne Lang with production assistance from Will Penny and Mark Prell. We are a production of Lit Radio and Northern California Public Media. Subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at krcb.org. Follow the podcast or program links. It's a novel idea. Cause it's one, two, three strikes, you're out at the old.